Okay, shall we start? Welcome to my talk about converting the FreeBSD documentation to the EPUB format. I am Benedikt Euschling. I'm fairly new to BSD CAN. It's my first time here, but I enjoy it very much. Nice people, great talks, and this is my humble contribution to that. So, to start, this is not a FreeBSD specific talk, so if you're from other projects, then this is the right place to be, because I'm more generally talking about EPUB, and I only use the FreeBSD documentation set as an example to, as a kind of walkthrough to the actual process of creating EPUBs. So you should find that it's very easy to convert any documents that you have to EPUB format, not just FreeBSD ones. I got to this EPUB thing about 6 months ago, plus minus, when I was at EuroBSDCon, and someone in the front row in the developer summit mentioned, hey, wouldn't it be great if we have EPUB format or EPUB output of our documentation? At the time, I didn't know anything about EPUB. I was completely new to that, and I thought, well, why not? Let's have a look. How hard could it be? Then, you know, you start looking, Googling the thing, and look up Wikipedia, what it has to say about that. And so I got into this, and what I found is it's pretty easy, as you might get from the talk later on, and that we actually should do this. It's kind of standard, or becoming more and more standard, for documentation to be published in EPUB format. So what I'm going to talk about is, I want to actually briefly motivate this EPUB thing. I think most of you that are here are already at least familiar from the talk description with EPUB. And then the two main parts are the actual introduction to EPUB. This is the kind of walkthrough I will do. I will kind of on the fly convert a document from the EPUB or from the actual FreeBSD documentation and show you step by step how you can convert a document into EPUB. And the second big part is the actual observation that I made when I converted the FreeBSD documentation set into EPUB, and some kind of or the different approaches that I took, namely the manual approach, the external converter approach, and the built-in approach. And then I'll conclude with some observations that I made during that process. So, briefly about, most of you I think should know about that, is what is actually the status of the FreeBSD documentation project? I think it's pretty good. We have many documents that we maintain, articles, books, the handbook, our websites and man pages. We're still at SGML-based docbook source code, so everything is being written into SGML and then gets translated or converted into these various outputs that I listed here. And we have more or less 19 translation projects, so the actual documentation gets translated. Some of them are not that active as they used to be, but we hope that we can kind of reactivate them and see what their problems are, because, you know, the more languages we have, the better. Yes? Not the man pages, but all the other things are in DocBook. Mostly it's developers who write the man pages, but the doc committers have also access to that source tree part to make corrections, grammar fixes, typo fixes. They have a kind of blanket commit into the source tree that they normally would not have for other source parts. So when I correct a typo in a, you know, in a source comment, that's accepted. If I would write actually or mess with the code, that would pretty much stir some trouble for me. And I think, at least for me, it was a good starting point to actually give something back to the FreeBSD project, because you don't actually have to know that much about coding or source stuff, because you can submit typo fixes, you can submit small snippets of your own how-tos. That's a good starting point to get further into the project if you want. So, wouldn't it be great to have all these good documents in your pocket so that you can carry them around, have them in the data center or somewhere else on the train where you don't have necessarily network connection, and you know, show it to other people, look something up, and wouldn't that be great that we have, that we could have that? And it turns out that EPUBs or ebooks are becoming more and more popular, as Michael would agree on. Yeah. Yeah. And there's also a widespread adoption of mobile devices, cell phones, you know, tablet computers. They're pretty much ubiquitous and everywhere right now, and that's a good thing, I think, because we can look something up on the go and have them, and don't have to carry around our big and hairy computers with us. And with that comes some different aspects, because these screens or these devices have different screen sizes. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but we have to adapt to that a little bit, because we are used to print or publish our documentation for computer screens that are relatively big and can put up big chunks of text. That's not necessarily true for the actual mobile devices. And what you don't want to have on a mobile device is horizontal scrolling or vertical scrolling. You don't want to continually zoom in and out, because that's not such a good reading experience if you continuously look or adjust your screen so that the actual document fits onto the screen. So what we want is we want to fit the screen, and regardless of its size, we want to put our document that we are displaying into the right dimensions of the screen. So, and this brings us directly to EPUB. EPUB is actually not an acronym, but it basically stands for Electronic Publications, and it's a standard or a specification developed at the International Documentation Publishing Foundation. And they have two definitions on their website that I found very descriptive to what EPUB actually is. I won't read it right now because it will be later in the talk slides, but what the one thing that you can drag out from both of these descriptions is the word reflowable. Reflowable is actually the thing that enables us to bring these different sized screens and use our documents to adjust depending on the size of the screen. That's what the reflowable means. So, now you might say, okay, but why shouldn't we use PDF? PDF wasn't actually developed for that kind of thing, because when PDF was developed, there weren't that many mobile devices around, and PDF has its own, you know, it's a pretty big standard right now. It has also some kind of stuff that we actually don't want on our mobile devices, because there is the capability of to embed actual code into PDFs. So when you're reading a PDF, possibly there is some script behind that can, you know, root your mobile phone or whatever. We want simply to display our documentation or any kind of publication that you can think of. And this is what EPUB was invented, because EPUB was invented with the focus that that there are different devices out there, different screen sizes, and they want to have some format that can actually fit onto these devices. And what they did is they didn't reinvent the wheel. That is the best thing about that, because we are also used of reusing our stuff. We don't want to learn specific markup language. We want to use the stuff that we are actually know that we want to, that we are using every day. So EPUB is basically composed of three standards: the OPF, the OPS, and the OCF. So what the OPF does is it defines basically what does each page look like in kind of formatting, in, you know, screen size or text size, the actual format of the font, and all that. This is the OPF. This is what everything contains in that. And the OPS is similar to that, but it's actually more concerned with what is actually contained in the book. is there a, you know, table of contents? Is there an appendix? Is there some kind of cover? And this is what the OPS is about. And the last thing that we will see in the next few slides is the actual open container format. So we have now a publication. We have currently, when we only take OPF and OPS, we have pages flying around, but we don't have actually a, you know, something that's holding it together. So we need a kind of container format to actually know, okay, this is the book cover, then the pages are coming, this is the end cover of the book. So let's have a look. I did this with a user's perspective in mind who never had actually used PDF before, so or EPUB before. EPUB, let's think about, you just downloaded an EPUB file and you want to know how you can create your own EPUB file. And what the curious Unix user or BSD user does is, we don't trust what we get on our computers. We just want to look at it, but we want to be careful about it. So let's have a look what this file command gives to us. And it turns out, ooh, it's something that we already know and use probably most of the time. It's a zip archive. And you think, wow, could it be that simple? Could I create actually zip files to, you know, create these mobile books? And my response is, yeah, it's that easy, but there are other parts that are not that easy, so you should stay focused and look what I'm coming up with in the next slides, because it's getting a little bit more complicated, but not that complicated enough to be, you know, scared about it. And now that you know that what kind of file format it is, you just simply try to extract that book. And it turns out there are some files behind it. And what I would like to do now is we go through each of these files. Most of them, or some of them, may be known to you, like PNGs and CSS. These are, you know, everything that you need to know about, you know, web pages, and that's probably not much explaining. That doesn't require much explaining. But the other files that are in there are a little bit more interesting to us, because that's where the actual logic or the actual book content is contained in. So what we get is the following tree, and this tree is actually compatible or configurable up to the point where we enter this OPS container. Everything below this OPS container is completely free for you. You can add subfolders, you can rename files, but the stuff above, the MIME type and the metainf container, XML, these must be as the specification suggests, because the EPUB readers actually look for these files. If they don't find them and they are in the wrong format, the EPUB won't be loaded. So you can do everything you want in the part where the OPS container is concerned. You can even rename it. It doesn't have to be OPS. You can rename it My eBook or whatever. But the stuff above it must be as it is right here. So MIME type files, not that interesting. I think most files of these contents or of this content type is pretty much known to you. Just create a text file, add application EPUB plus zip to it, and save it and be done with it. Be careful not to encrypt this file or compress it, because the EPUB reader is parsing that file, and if it can't read it because there are some chunks missing in it, it gives up and says it can't display that ebook. The next thing is the metainf directory. This is where some files are stored and that are necessary to tell the EPUB reader, okay, what kind of book is this, what kind of, you know, digital restrictions management is on there, if you have that, or what kind of other, you know, encryption algorithms are on there. You can leave all these three out, the signatures, the encryptions, and the writes XML, but the one thing that you need in every EPUB is the container XML. And this basically describes to the EPUB reader where it will find the rest of the content. If you know how to set up a web server, you might know this as a document root. This is basically the same thing. This is why it's called the root file to the publication. And this is how it looks like. So it's basically an XML file with its namespace on it. And this is the only thing that you specify here. It's where to find its actual root file. So where in this publication structure is the file that it should load to the EPUB reader to parse that file. And the interesting thing is that it doesn't, or it must not be relative to the meta-inf directory. So anything that you can put below that file structure, you can put into your own full path. So it doesn't have to be OPS content OPF. It could be my ebook / OPS / chapter 1 / whatever. As long as it's referring to the content OPF, you should be fine. So now we have our basic structure. Now we want to fill in the content for the book. We want our text inside, some pictures, and we want to have some nice style to it. Maybe some text formatting or different fonts in our book. That's everything that you can put into that book, and it's pretty flexible in that regard because you can reuse basically everything that you know from XHTML. You can put complete websites on the fly into ebooks or ebooks. And yes? 1-1, because this is what they took for the actual specifications. The difficulties are not that many. I have a separate slide for that. So with a few exceptions, you can use the complete XHTML tag set for that. And if you want, you can use embedded fonts, but you have to supply them within the EPUB. And what you also can do is embed images. You can, and you should, use all the images that you are using in the book. You should embed it into this zip archive folder. If you want to reference external images, that may be a little bit problematic. It may work depending on the implementation of the actual EPUB reader, but most of the time it won't just work the actual file, because you cannot guarantee on your mobile phone that you are actually constantly connected onto the internet and pull that image when it's required. It's the same thing or similar thing with external links. So you can put links into your EPUB, but sometimes they won't work. They won't load properly because some EPUB readers are just displaying the EPUBs and don't have an actual embedded web browser in them. So that's a little bit complicated, and it depends on the actual EPUB reader how that's implemented. But inner references are also a little bit problematic, not in that regard that it doesn't work, but more in the regard that you have to rethink how you structure your book. You just cannot say anymore, please jump to file or to page 15, because page 15 is now, depending on how big your screen is, reflowable or reflows to other pages, and you have to set anchors like you do it in HTML as well, so you can actually jump from the table of contents to the specific chapter. Yeah. You can use those, but you don't have to necessarily expect that it works all the time. I would recommend to use different EPUB readers to test your EPUB, so you can know, okay, this works on most of the EPUB readers that are tested. If you test it only with one EPUB reader and you load it on another, it may not work. Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. You basically say these sections or these chapters are contained in the book, and from there you can jump through the actual chapters. And another thing that I like is that they left out completely all that JavaScript stuff into that specification. So there is no possibility that someone can, you know, create a malicious book with some JavaScript code that may root your mobile phone or your Kindle or what have you. And EPUB readers are not required to parse that stuff. They just skip over it. So, and because we don't have any of that stuff in our FreeBSD documentation, no fancy JavaScript, we have no problem using that or ignore it completely. And I would highly recommend to structure your books that maybe become bigger. So for our handbook, possibly we should use separate, you know, chapters or subfolders where we can put these different chapters that we have inside to have it structures, to have, or to have a big book more structured, that we should put, we shouldn't put everything in one directory. We should use some more structured way, like subdirectories, for example. Okay, so now, how do I define the table of contents? The table of contents is basically defined in that content NCX. And this specification is not being done by the IDPF. They borrowed it from an existing one. It's called the one from the DAISY Consortium. DAISY Consortium, DAISY stands for Digital Accessibility Information Systems. It's a, you know, industry consortium to create documentation to help people who are not capable or have problems reading books like normal people would. Not necessarily problems with the actual reading, but they sometimes have problems to go to the next side, or they don't know how to read a book in a certain kind of format. So from one page after another, they might skip two pages. So these DAISY specifications help users with these disabilities to navigate these books like normal people would. And what they do is they define a big navigation map, and within these navigation maps are navigation points that you can jump to. And in these navigation points, they say, okay, chapter 2 follows after chapter 1. And so you can define which reading order is actually appropriate to read your publication. And you can also define chapters, sections, subsections, however you want it, in all these content NCX files. Question? Yeah. No, what? Yeah, sure, you can say, okay, yeah. This is completely free up. This is completely up to you. You can structure or define your book however you want it. That's not actually concerned with the actual specification. They give you the freedom to structure your book how you like it. So how does that file look? It's another XML file. And what I did here with these slides is I couldn't cram all the whole source file of that file into one big slide. And I didn't want to put it up on, you know, 8-point fonts so that no one could read it. So I basically took chunks of these files, displayed it in this big blue box that we here see, and afterwards, when I'm done with this block, I will put it up, and so this whole file will be, you know, moved to the top of that slide. So basically, XML file, that this is the introduction line that all XML files have. Then we define the actual namespace of the DAISY Corporation or a consortium, and now it moves up. So what we define here is actually meta information that you also know from XHTML publications or web pages. And what you define here, these are the mandatory ones. This is the title of your publication. If that one is missing, don't blame me if the EPUB reader can't display it, because it doesn't know what kind of title it should give. And you also have to define a unique identifier. It doesn't have to be a URL. It could also be a hash. As long as it is unique, the EPUB specification is fine with that. And you can also define how the depth of your actual table of contents file. So you could increase that number if you want to have subsections, sub-subsections, and all that. And you also want not to limit your book to actual page sizes. You want the EPUB reader to figure out how many pages that the publication has for itself. Because if you enter actual values for that, for like total page count, and you have a different screen size, it will only go, let's say, to page 15. And even if you have more into that, it won't display after page 15. So leave it to zero and let the EPUB reader figure it out for itself. So this was the head. And then you define the actual documentation or the document title. This is necessary information. You might say, okay, I've already defined this in the head. Why should I reuse it again in the actual doc title tag? It's necessary because the specification requires that. And basically, it's a one-line edit, so it shouldn't take much time. And this is the actual nav map I was talking about. So you can say, okay, chapter one is the first thing that should be displayed to the users when they open this EPUB or when they click on the actual chapter one part of the table of contents. Then it should say, or then it says, which actual file within this EPUB file contains the source for the chapter one. In this example, it's chapter1.xml. So this is the actual content of the NCX file. The problem is each EPUB reader is a little bit different in that regard, that it either parses content NCX or content OPF first. And some of the information that you put in content NCX and in content OPF is kind of overlapping. You do basically the work twice, but you're then on the safe side that different EPUB readers will parse your EPUBs correctly. So now that we've known the content NCX file, let's look at the content OPF file. The OPF file is concerned about how can the book be compiled as a complete distribution. How can we compile this book so in such a way that we can read it through as a complete book like we would in the real world? So, again, it references the NCX table of contents file. So these files kind of depend on each other. And its basic structure, it has certain tags that I will explain in the next slide. And the interesting part about the content OPF file is that it is referenced originally by the container XML file. So when the EPUB reader opens that EPUB, it parses the container XML file, and then it looks, okay, where is the content OPF? And some readers implement it like that they actually parse then the content OPF file, but others parse the content NCX file first. And this is kind of problematic because it should be that it is like that the content OPF file is parsed, but that's implementation specific. So we have to live with that. Okay, the content OPF file is another XML file, so everything that you do in EPUB is XML based. Again, this is the namespace, it's not that interesting. The interesting part is that unique identifier that we will see in the next section, because this is where it gets referenced. So we provide, again, some metadata, the actual language that the publication is actually published in, the actual title again, and this is the actual identifier for the book ID referenced in the package section. Again, this should not or must not be a HTML or an actual URL. It can also be a hash or whatever you have, as long as this is unique. And then you provide the actual manifest. What's in the manifest is in the book. What's not in the manifest is not in the book, even if you provide it in the zip file. So you can cram all the stuff into the zip file. If it's not in the manifest, the EPUB reader will happily ignore it. So these are the things that you need to define in order to make your book render as you want it to be. And these are some of the files that we already have seen, some of the files that may be new. So for example, we have a cover, so we can define a cover for our book. Nice and shiny. And you may know text CSS. What you may stumble upon a little bit is, why did I use application XHTML plus XML? When I usually code HTML, isn't that, text HTML? Yes, it is, but in the EPUB world, we use application XHTML plus XML. If you don't know that, and you use it the other way around, it won't work. So just provide application XHTML, and you will be fine. And this is where you list all of the sections, all of the pages that are contained within your publication. If it's not in the manifest, it won't load. And then we have the actual spine. You can compare the spine with the actual, backside of the book, where it, holds and everything together. And this is where it says, okay, if you open that file, then begin with chapter one. You can also say, okay, begin with the table of contents, but most EPUB reader load the table of contents afterwards, or before the chapter one. And there is also an optional guide section that is used for providing semantic information. And when you want to have a shiny little book cover for your EPUB, which I'll show on the next slide, this is where you define that. So in the guide section is the actual EPUB cover defined. So let's have a little look at cover definitions. So we want a little shiny BSD daemon on our EPUB. And it's perfectly doable. It's pretty simple. It's a separate XHTML file. You can put simple text on it, your big headline. Or you can also say, okay, I have a nice graphic artwork that I want to use. And you can use these four file formats. And basically what you do is create a guide section. And within that guide, add a spine. And you add the little attribute linear no to that one. That's it. This tells the EPUB reader that this is not part of the actual book, but it's the first thing that it should display when it's on, when the EPUB is loaded. And I have a screenshot here. This is how it looks in Apple iBooks. So the right ones are, the BSD daemon reading some documentation. And this is actually depending on what the actual EPUB reader makes of it. So Apple iBooks is pretty intelligent with that, so that it's, if it's, in landscape mode, that it actually moves that page or that book into the right position. But there are other EPUB readers in software that will basically just display the image, and there's no nice rendering in book format like here. And on the left side, it's basically, if you only have, text for your cover, then this is what it looks like. So now we have our book complete. Let's do the other thing around. Now we create or compile our book. And, what we have to do is move all these files that we just saw back into an XML or a zip file that the actual EPUB reader is able to load and render. So what we need to do, as I said, we must not compress the MIME type, because then the EPUB reader won't make any sense of it. So we add it without compression and all, and leave out the extra attributes that are added by the actual file system. And after that has been done, we add recursively all the other contents of the book into that zip file. Here you can compress all you want, the more the better, because all the mobile phones in the world won't have that much storage space, and the more you compress it, the better it is. As long as you don't compress the MIME type XML, it should be fine. So, and then you're done. Let's publish it and go out. Oh, but wait. How about validating that thing? So, after all, you validate your XML files, right? Because you don't want to embarrass yourself with poorly written HTML files. So let's use some software that checks that everything is correct and that the EPUB is actually conforming to the specifications. And there's a nice program in the Google code. It's called EPUBCheck. And you simply run it using a JavaScript or a Java executable, like a jar file. And then it will spill out all the problems that it could find, all the errors that you made. And if there is no output and it just says, well done, no errors found, it's completely value that, or it certifies you in a way that this EPUB is correct. You can also, some publishers do that. They offer, that you upload your EPUB and they check it for you using that EPUB check software. And then they give you a nice web page and tell you, okay, this book is actually valid and doesn't have any errors in it. So if anyone is interested in porting that into our, or adding that into our ports collection, please do it, or tell me how I do it. So, yeah. Okay, this is actually the actual process how to create EPUB. It's not that difficult. You could basically copy and paste everything from my slides and adapt it to your needs. But now we want to look at how can we do the stuff automatically, because we don't want to hand edit everything, because it's kind of a drawn out processes, and we have so many documentations or documents out there that, you know, it's kind of gets not that interesting. We want the computers to do that. And so we could do basically three approaches. The first one is not that interesting to most of us, because it's basically doing everything by hand. So what you do is, the thing that is most interesting to us is that we actually don't have XML output from our SGML yet, because we want to move from our SGML output to XML in the SGML docbook. And the only thing close to that is the actual rendering of our web pages. So anything that can render in XHTML is the closest thing that we currently have to XML. And what we basically do is create that file folder, that file structure, and then copy, starting at the body tag from the HTML file, all the content over into our XML files in the EPUB, and then add our, you know, CSS, the images, and make sure that all the references are still valid in the new EPUB world. And then, you know, create the EPUB and validate it and see how it renders on different devices and different EPUB readers. And most of the time people forget to verify that when they click on a certain link in a table of contents that they actually get to the site that they are clicking on. Most of the time they click on something, either the talk brings them nowhere because the actual destination is missing, or it gets thrown to you completely different part of the document where you didn't want to go. So you should verify that the links from the table of contents work correctly. There is a nice software. It's kind of a EPUB all you want package. It's called Calibre by Covid Goyal. Each time I start it, there's a new version available, so it's pretty much under heavy development right now. It's a complete EPUB library management, or ebook library management in general. It can also pull down, you know, RSS feeds and put them into EPUBs. It's pretty sophisticated software, in my opinion. And so what I did, I gave him the whole FreeBSD handbook as a PDF and said, okay, please give me an output as a docbook or a handbook EPUB. And it took like 20 minutes to parse through all that stuff. It's not that interesting because there is no actual progress bar, so you wait and think, oh, is it still running, or just had it hang up? But then it spills out the result, and what you get is a 3 megabyte EPUB file with, when you load it on Apple iBooks, which I did, is about 7,120 pages long. And the problem was that it had many duplicates, so the whole table of content looked like installing FreeBSD, like 20 pages long. And this is not what you want to get. You have to manually edit. The most parts are done automatically, but you have to manually fine-tune and check that everything is still working. You cannot just rely on the whole converter process. You have to manually check everything afterwards. I think it's because it was directly taken from the PDF, and when the so we basically convert from HTML to PDF and from PDF to EPUB, and I think there was much stuff lost in that process already, so we should have a direct approach, which I'm coming to next, from direct HTML or XML into EPUB. So this is not to say that Calibre is bad in that regard. Smaller document sizes may be rendered differently or better in that, but you should always check what you get from the converter. Okay, and then I looked around in our big documentation to-do list, and I saw, hey, there's a guy working on actual moving from HTML docbook to XML. And Gabor and Hiroki are pretty much have put many hours of work into that. And that was helpful for me because I had the opportunity then to move directly from XML into EPUB format, which is what we want. And so this status is a little bit old, like a few months, but they succeeded in converting every book, every article that we have in our current FreeBSD documentation set into DocBook in the new XML world, because DocBook HTML won't be there for long anymore. So we have to actually make the jump into XML world. It might be a little bit rough, but I think it's worthwhile that we do that. And there are some entity issues remaining, namely that we need to kind of convert all the entities that we have in our current HTML doc set into XML entities, because they're a little bit different. And this is the most time-consuming part in that process. And we're also currently investigating the XSL formatting objects option to create actual PDFs. This is a little bit problematic, as it turned out. I talked to them, or at least to Hiroki, about that, because we currently have no way to create PDFs from XML DocBook directly. There are some Java converters, but hey, we don't want to have Java convert our documentation because it's so heavyweight, and that's, I think, easier to be done with other tools, but we have to find them first. And there are also problems, not so much that it's problematic, but it's kind of new to our documentation, or it could be new to our documentation developers to use XML, because it's more strict with that regard, that you can sometimes, or you cannot drop some certain XML tags like you could do in HTML. HTML is not that strict in that regard, but XML is really, really pedantic about that. And what we also need to do is change the actual build infrastructure so we can automatically create these files. But once we're there, that's pretty much where we want to go. So these guys have done pretty much all the work that needs to be done. We just have to do the final step in making sure that HTML gets thrown out everywhere we have it, and then move to XML world and probably never look back. So this allows that we could use the DocBook's built-in XML EPUB converter. It's a script. It's working pretty good. You provide an XML file. You say, okay, I want to have an EPUB, and it converts them on the fly, and then you have a working EPUB converter, or a working EPUB that is validated and it's correct, and you could publish it right on the spot. So these are the lessons learned from our initial approaches. Clearly, the entries in the table of contents are the most problematic, because when they get converted wrong, or they don't actually point to the actual destination that they need to go, each of these entries have to be manually checked before you can say, okay, this is a correct EPUB and this works as intended. And we're still at XHTML 1.0 in our EPUB, or in our documentation project, but the difference are not that big, because most of the things that I did is, you know, a search and replace to for the name attributes and replace them with IDs. This is what's been used in the EPUB, and the actual EPUB validators check for that. If you use name attributes, they will complain. And we can also pretty much reuse our current DocBox CSS, where we have our FreeBSD-specific, you know, corporate identity. Not much changes are required there. We basically can use it and move it to EPUB world. And I would say to that is that we made, at some point in the past, before my time, the good decision of not using that much exotic tags in the FreeBSD documentation set, because these are now deprecated anyway. So we don't have any special stuff, no special eye candy, no special syntactic sugar on that. We use the tags that are used or that are out there, and we don't have to, you know, kind of rework all that anymore. It's pretty much very easy process to reuse these HTML files and move them over to XML. And again, open standards are pretty much the thing to go, because we don't have to relearn anything anymore. We could use all our knowledge that we have gained from hours of hacking, you know, XHTML, web pages, and CSS. That's not obsolete. We can use it in EPUB as well as in web pages. And from my understanding, or from what I gathered from that process, is that overall documentation for open source projects, not just the FreeBSD documentation, is a very good candidate for EPUBs, because that's the way to go. People want to have it on their mobile phones, people want to have it on their tablet computers, and if you can pull that off and offer it to our user base, they will be very happy about that. And so what I gathered from these conversions, or from these converting tries, is that we should definitely use the XML DocBook built-in approach, so that we can use that script that the DocBook projects provide and use these to create the actual EPUBs. And if something is wrong with that, we can complain to the actual DocBook people about not generating the EPUBs correctly. Maybe it's something wrong with our documentation, but I doubt it at that point. Once we are at XML DocBook, we won't have any much trouble doing the actual creation of EPUBs. So, to sum it up, here are some screenshots I did from Apple iBooks. Looks pretty well for that actual article that I used to create these. You can see that it actually marks up, you know, links that you actually visited, so on the middle part here. And there's also some nice rendering of, you know, when you have some special, you know, these kind of boxes where you explain certain rcconf options. I pretty much like it, and this is more about how the different formatting is being displayed. So if you know how the actual FreeBSD documentation looks like, you will know, or you can see, that pretty much everything gets carried over into EPUB, and it renders pretty nicely. Yeah, exactly. I disabled most of them, because it doesn't make sense to actually jump within the EPUB into another section of that small article. But you could make it that way, so that you can jump from the actual article onto the web. But it's working not on all the EPUB readers, because it's implementation specific. That's... Yeah, sure, definitely. Yeah. I also did a test run. We have our manual pages on the web in XHTML format, so we can. This is the LS manual page, and this renders also pretty nicely. And on the last part is I removed all these links here at these kind of sections, because they also don't make sense to actually move from these. What I removed in the, let me go back for a little bit. On each page in the actual FreeBSD documentation, we have a kind of footer where we have a link to the previous page, or to the home, or to the next page. I removed these because they're obsolete in this EPUB world, because there is no previous page on or the previous page on the iPad looks different than the previous page on the Kindle because of the different screen sizes. So use what's being put. For EPUB, it's obsolete. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. They all do it with XSLT transformations. So you can actually define a rule that says, okay, if it's EPUB output, so then ignore these footers for the next previous and all these links. Yeah. Yeah, we could do that, but there are also some other drawbacks from SGML. The DocBook people moved on, and all the other, or most of the other open source projects moved with them. So we are one of the last ones that are still at SGML. Yeah, it's not bad in that regard, but if you want more, like EPUBs and all the other shiny stuff that comes with it, you... Yeah. In each case, we have to edit manually our make infrastructure. We won't have a workaround about that. We must do that, but we can do it in a way that's easy, or we can use it in a way, or we can do it in a way that's more complicated. And I prefer the easy part, to use the DocBook XML converters. Yeah. To each his own. Okay, any questions? Yes. When will I be done? I need to go back to Gabor and Hiroki about the actual last status about their conversion run. But I think they are on a good way to make it happen in a few months. I know Gabor is pretty much wound up with actual studies and other stuff that he's doing, but he gave me a source drop of his current version back then, and there are still some entity issues remaining, but I think we're getting there. It's a little bit tedious process to convert all these, but once we're there, we won't be having any more trouble with that. Yeah, at the moment, yeah. Because we have to, at the current time, we still must maintain the SGML parallel to the XML version. And once we are happy that the XML version does everything that SGML does, we can move the actual jump, or we can make the actual jump to XML and leave the SGML. Yeah, that's the other problem that we're still investigating. How can we fix that? Yeah. And we don't want to lose anything during that. We want to have more in XML world, but we also want to make sure that we drag everything over from the old world. Yeah. I'm not opposed to Java in general, but for a simple or a, in that regard, simple process of just converting a document into another format, bringing up all this heavy Java stuff, it's a little bit, you know, too much in my opinion. We should make sure before we make the actual jump to XML that we can also generate the PDFs in a way that they look correctly and they work as they did with SGML. So if you want to have more information like this, I found some nice tutorials that I used. They pretty much explain everything. They will be in the conference website once the slides are up, and then you can look at them, and they are pretty much everything that you need to know. All right. Thank you.